Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this month's Hancock & Whitney Bank's Economic Update Call. Hancock Bank and Whitney Bank provide this call as a monthly economic update for general informational purposes only. Information provided during the call is not intended to be an investment advice. Opinions are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of Hancock Holding Company or its affiliates. If you have any questions, please email them to me, David Lundgren, and my email address is david.lundgren, L-U-N-D-G-R-E-N, at hancockbank.com. This morning I have with me John Porwood, Chief Investment Officer, and Luther McDougall, Greg Hedleski, and Jeff Tangus, all investment directors. And John, I think the best place to start is with Chairman Bernanke's comments back on June 19th. And just for those of you that missed it, on June 19th, Chairman Bernanke stated that the downside risks to the outlook for the economy and the labor market have diminished. He went on to further state, if the incoming data are broadly consistent with this forecast, the committee currently anticipates that it would be appropriate to moderate the pace of purchases later this year. And then finally, he stated, we will continue to reduce the pace of purchases in measured steps through the first half of next year, ending purchases around mid-year. And, of course, this was all dependent on the economic data if it comes in as they anticipate. So that was pretty big news for the markets and the economy. So if you could, maybe, give us an idea that the market reacted pretty negatively to these comments. So give us your thoughts. Was it overreaction, appropriate?
It does appear to be a pretty significant overreaction, and I guess to talk about this subject, we could probably spend an hour on this, but obviously we don't have an hour, and we've got to cover a lot of ground, so I'll try to be as succinct as possible. If you look at Bernanke's comments on June the 19th, in the context of what sort of argument has been going on within and outside of the Fed among economists over the last 4 or 5 months, you can see that it appears to be a culmination of some discussions concerning whether or not QE, the quantitative easing program, is doing what it's supposed to be doing, namely stimulating the economy, and there's quite a bit of question about that, or is it really creating here and there asset price bubbles and distorting the financial markets and the economy in a way that will prove fairly damaging down the road when the Fed, tries to normalize things. With that in mind, and if you look at what was happening to various asset prices over the last several months, there was already some movement in the direction of, let's say, reducing carry or reducing investments in various projects and activities that were highly dependent on QE. So you were beginning to see, some decline in prices in the bond market, some wavering of the stock market a bit as this information was coming out from the Fed and from other sources. It appears that Bernanke's comments reflected more a desire to avoid future distortions that appear to be becoming, rather obvious in the economy and to prevent any problems down the road, rather than in anticipation of a significant improvement in economic activity, rising inflation, and so forth and so on. That, we think, is probably the best way to look at Bernanke's comments. But when you consider that up to this point, the Federal Reserve and Bernanke have sort of implied by their statements that QE would continue perhaps not into infinity, but at least pretty steadily for the next several years, his comments did provide something of a shock to the markets, even though he said nothing about tightening. He said nothing about, taking away the punch bowl immediately, but just the mere fact that he even discussed the idea that it might taper off sooner than everyone had anticipated created a lot of selling in the market, again, particularly from those areas of the market that were supported primarily by QE. And once the idea that QE would be reduced became prominent, those particular investment activities were less viable than they were. And that created some selling, which, of course, led to even more selling, and it kind of fed upon itself, and leading to what appears to be a panic in the retail bond investor space, with something like $80 billion coming out of bond mutual funds of all kinds in the last several weeks. And to me, that smacks more of the end of a move rather than the beginning. And when you think about it, most of that money went into cash. So if short-term rates don't go up, and there's very little chance that the Fed is going to try to tighten at this point, and again, there's no reason for short-term rates to rise at this point, that money sitting in cash is likely to get a little bit nervous about earning no money at all and probably come back into the bond market. So so for that reason, we think this is, and other reasons, this is probably, you know, more like the end of a move, a shock, so to speak, rather than the beginning. And to go back to the rationale behind QE in the first place, it was really designed to create a wealth effect by lowering corporate bond rates and encouraging investment. And the thought was that higher stock prices would boost consumer wealth, help increase confidence, spur spending, and lead to higher incomes and profits, you know, that would, again, feed upon the, in themselves and further support economic expansion. Well, it hasn't worked out that way. You know, the year-over-year economic growth rate is 1.6. We haven't really reached a 2% on average growth rate since the recession ended in 2009. So, again, it gets back to that thought that the Fed has created more market distortions and perhaps, you know, the fear of more market distortions down the road rather than doing the economy a great deal of good. So,
well, let's go ahead and talk about the economy. You know, we just obviously completed the second quarter. You kind of touched on it. You know, what are we looking at for the second quarter in terms of GDP? And then I guess the really important question is, and let's make an assumption that the Fed begins to step away from their bond purchase program, what happens to the economy for the remainder of 2013?
At this point, I'm not sure anyone really knows to what extent the Fed's QE program is actually supporting the economy. That's still a question that we can only answer, you know, once they really step away in a noticeable sense, and we can see what happens. But again, growth rate in the economy since the Great Recession ended has been less than 2%. The first quarter has been revised down several times. The latest revision was, I think, Dave helped me, 1.8%, somewhere in that range, with a fairly noticeable decline in real disposable income and real wage increases, which has been, you know, something that has, you know, plagued the economy for quite some time. Coincident indicators of economic activity suggest that we're operating at something of a below-trend pace now. Second quarter, some people actually think the second quarter may be fairly close to zero. We never like to make projections like that from one quarter to the next because it's, you know, it's really a guess as to what's going to happen. But certainly the second quarter does not appear to be significantly stronger than the first. Consensus estimates for the remainder of the year or somewhere in the 2.5% range, and of course we consistently see you know, estimates for a year or two out at 3% plus, which has been the constant refrain ever since the bust. And as we've talked often about what happens historically after major credit busts, it's awfully hard to get you know, back to a real high growth environment until a lot of the debt burden has been reduced, and that's certainly been the case so far, you know, in this experience. So we're probably looking at, say, you know, 2% GDP growth for some time, but certainly the second half of the year is no longer looking quite as strong as some people had anticipated. Inflation is low. Personal consumption expenditure is something the Fed looks at as a gauge to what's really happening in the price environment. Came in at 0.7% year over year. CPI is not a great deal more than that. So you know, you've got a slow growth, low inflation environment, and we see absolutely no sign at all that the velocity of money, the turnover of money, has really changed at all. It's low and still declining. So, you know, the banks have a lot of money to lend. Lending or borrowing demand is relatively slow. So, you know, all things put together, you know, we're still looking at a pretty, you know, pretty tepid economic environment, which again is we know, we think, supportive of bond prices. If you don't have a lot of inflation and you don't have outsized economic growth, it does not suggest that you're at the beginning of a sustained increase in interest rates. So, you know, that's, you know, basically the story of low growth, low inflation, disinflation of some sort, perhaps some deflationary forces existing in different areas of the economy still continues.
All right, Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
Let's go ahead and talk a little bit about stocks. June was an interesting month. I think the market was a little spooked by the prospect of Fed tapering, as we discussed. And it was really the first difficult month the market has seen in a while. The S&P 500 finished the month down 1.34%, but still having a very nice 2013. Year-to-date through June 30th, the market is up 13.8%. And I believe that's the best first half of a year, calendar year, since 1998. I guess the, you know, June was notable in that it was the first negative month in a while. But not only was it negative, we saw a pretty significant jump in volatility. Give us your thoughts. Was it a minor pullback, all related to the tapering comments? And maybe where do we go from here?
Yeah, actually, it was about the third month, consecutive month in a row where volatility spiked up. I think the market was really looking for a catalyst or a reason to maybe sell off. We were down almost 6% from the May highs. You know, disparity between stock prices and the underlying weakness in the economy continues. And I think, you know, something has to give. Either the economy has to pick up, or stock prices are going to adjust. And I think that was probably a bit of a correction that we needed. Whether that is over with, I don't know. I would suspect that we can probably expect a little bit more volatility since it seems to be in an increasing uptrend. But, yeah, unless that disparity between the slow growth and corporate earnings growth, right now we're seeing basically flat earnings growth for the second quarter. And for every one company that's issuing positive guidance, you've got four issuing negative guidance. So that's not a good situation to be in, or at least it doesn't portend higher stock prices. So I think that we probably are still ripe for other pullbacks. Again, this one was almost, roughly 6%. Could we see something a little bit more? I mean, we've had some up days again in the market, but I think it's a real concern still going forward that we need to see some earnings growth, and if we're going to have that upturn in the second half, we're going to need some more positive guidance from companies, and we're just not seeing it at this point.
Okay. Thanks, Greg. And John, in our meeting yesterday, you had some interesting comments about market dynamics that we've experienced over the last month. You want to share with our listeners what we talked about yesterday?
That was in terms of valuation and quality?
Yeah, the quality.
The quality story?
Yeah.
It was really interesting what happened in the last month. The higher quality stocks actually and lower volatility stocks actually declined more in this correction than the other, you know, than the more volatile stocks. It's kind of unusual. Some of that may be due to the fact that the desire for, you know, dividend income and high yield may have pushed, you know, that group of securities up a little more than you would have expected, I guess, prior to that. Mm-hmm. You know, they might have been a little bit overvalued. And now that overvalue situation seems to be, you know, being corrected. So it was kind of odd, really an odd situation where you'd have, you know, high quality and low volatility stocks underperform on a decline in the market like that.
Right.
But it could be just simply because the quality stocks got a little overdone on the upside before that.
Yeah, and it could be associated to the backup in yields that we've experienced.
Oh, yeah, right, the backup in yields, that's true.
Which is perfect introduction to Luther. Are you with us, Luther?
I'm here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I guess when we talked back in May, we had talked about the 10-year Treasury yield for the month of May. It jumped almost 0.5%. It went from 1.7 to a little bit over 2.1%. And then here in June, same type of scenario. We went at the end of June, we were a little bit above 2.1, and now we're right around 2.5%. So really over a two-month period, it wasn't quite 1%, but getting pretty close. And I think at some point we were up 1% and dropped off a little bit at the end of June. So, you know, I guess the question is the market anticipating the economy or inflation or both picking up? Or is this move also as a result of anticipated tapering or reducing the amount of bonds that the Fed is purchasing, or is it some combination of the two? What do you think?
It's some combination of the two. I think if you look back, May was more was driven a little bit more by a pickup in the economy, and as John mentioned or touched on a lot of this, but the economy is fairly tepid, but I think it's a better tepid than many expected, if that makes any sense. So in May, we got some numbers from the economy, and they've kind of continued showing that the economy is doing a little bit better, particularly in the housing area, in autos. Consumer confidence was up last month and this month. Consumer spending, although, you know, still relatively low, is doing okay. A lot of those numbers came out in May and have continued through in June. But I think most of what's happened this month is a direct result of the Federal Reserve. And the way I heard it put best is that the market demonstrated no patience for the Fed's message of a gradual approach to the end of monetary easing. They only heard the word "in," and then the market sold off based upon that. But we have to remember that the Federal Reserve came out and said that although they do expect to begin to reduce their monthly bond purchases and eventually stop those, their timeline was sometime by the middle of next year that the purchases would end based upon the employment rate reaching about 7%. Part of the issue is that local or the U.S. economists in general have a better, higher forecast or better forecast than the Fed themselves and think that the unemployment rate may reach 7% before the end of this year. So there's a little bit of a disconnect between the overall expectations of the Fed and economists in general, and that's not unusual. I think the Federal Reserve is showing an abundance of caution, and the economists are just, you know, giving it their best. But I think all of that together, in May it was economic numbers, and in June it was the tapering talk, helped to push interest rates up. We'll have to wait and see what happens, but we do know that the Fed is not going to do anything until the data arrives in a manner in which they're expecting or hoping for, meaning that all of the decisions are data-dependent, not time-dependent. I think the market's kind of missing out on that, but we'll have to wait and see. But in general, the economy seems to be doing okay. Whether we got the direct result that we wanted from QE is a question that'll be answered in a decade or so. But it looks like we are coming to the end of QE. We do also have to remember that the Fed has said nothing about eliminating easing or tightening. It's just going to be a slow reduction in the easy monetary policy that we've been going through now, I guess, for 21 months of QE. Everybody was expecting it to go on forever, but it had to come to an end at some time, and I think last month everybody kind of woke up and got the message that QE is going to begin to slow down, if not end, in the next year or so.
Okay. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning.
You heard Luther's comments in regards to the Treasury market. I know it was also a pretty interesting month for municipal bonds. Care to give us your thoughts on that?
Sure. Yeah, it was a characterized, I would say, as a roller coaster ride for the municipal bond market, which is really not unusual. The muni market is probably the most inefficient of most of the major markets that we have here in the United States. Certainly the taxable bond markets tend to be a lot more efficient. Municipal bond funds are primarily a mom-and-pop retail type of product, so they tend to behave a little differently, and I think that probably is one of the big reasons why June was such a chaotic month for the municipal bond market. We saw, as Luther talked about, we started seeing rates in taxable securities back up back into May, actually, and even a little bit prior to that. The muni market really resisted for a long time. Being more retail-oriented, it tends to move slower. But we saw a capitulation in early June, where muni bond prices started going down, rates started going up, and as we went through the month, the selling pressure continued to build as retail investors looked at their bond funds and looked at some of the NAV, their net asset value, and started to rethink their investments. But really what happened was towards the end of the month, the rise in yields continued to take place, we got near the end of the month, which was a quarter end for a lot of Wall Street firms, broker dealers, and a year end for some of them. And why that's important is, all bond markets rely on the broker-dealers community to provide access to buying and selling. They act as the intermediary. So when the muni market started rising and mutual funds started to liquidate bonds to handle some redemptions, that came coincidentally with more towards the end of the month. As we got close to the end of the month, the broker-dealer community became less and less willing to act as that intermediary. And the reason was broker-dealers typically don't want to own bonds at the end of a quarter and certainly at the end of their fiscal year because of their financial reporting. So it just was June was really a perfect storm in the municipal market. Several things came together to really conspire to cause a vacuum or a free fall in municipal bond prices and a rise in yields for a period of time. It was a short-term phenomenon. We've already passed that, and life goes back to normal, and this does happen pretty regularly. It's not as accentuated or as exaggerated because we normally don't have the combination of rising interest rates happening right in the face of a quarter or a year in. Just to kind of give you an example, long-term municipals at the beginning of June were somewhere around 4.3%. They actually rose to almost 90 basis points, almost a full percentage point towards the end of the month to 5.2%, and that was much more than the taxable market had sold off. So it was really overreacting. And then once we worked past the end of the month, bond prices began to rise again, and the yield ended up being up about a half a percentage point, which is, roughly speaking, that's about what the Treasury markets and all were up in yield as well. So it was a roller coaster ride brought on by just the cycle of financial reporting in the broker dealer community, and thank goodness that's all behind us now. and things have returned back to normal again. So we've muni markets are getting back in line with the taxable markets now, but because of some of the inefficiencies in the muni market, it led to a much more chaotic and somewhat of a roller coaster ride for the month of June. So that's a long, windy explanation, a little technical and kind of wonky in a lot of respects, but it was a highly unusual month for muni bonds.
And I guess along those same lines, and you've already kind of touched on it, as did John, in June we had record outflows from bond funds, and I know it's difficult to predict, but, I mean, do you see that trend continuing? And I guess what is the impact to bond fund investors?
Well, I suspect that investors will see the biggest competition the bond market has is the stock market. That's the bottom line for the retail investing community, which is what the muni market typically is invested by. So I suspect that there will be some gradual liquidations along the way. My guess is, like John and Luther, though, I don't see the economy showing the strength that's warranted for sort of the wholesale liquidation that people were fearing in the month of June. So bond funds, the bottom line is we had, I guess in all bond funds last year, we had about $310 billion flow into bond funds last year. So we've had a lot of money flow into bond funds over the last 12 to 18 months. And so, you know, not all that money is going to stay there. Some of it will move out. But certainly bond funds, still the rates are much more attractive now than they have been in a while. So I think that's going to be a big incentive for people to retain their bond funds.
Let me mention something, Jeff, along those lines. Jeff and I were talking yesterday, and Jeff, correct me if I'm off on this, but I believe a 10-year municipal bond, AA yield, produced today, or at least as of yesterday, produced a taxable equivalent yield of about 4.5%. It's the 31% tax bracket. And roughly, what, 5% if you're in a 40% tax bracket, the highest tax bracket?
Right, that was over 5% if you're in a max tax bracket type situation, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another reason why we don't expect to see the parade of outflows in bond funds, because in the muni product, because munis got very cheap, but they're still even now they're still relatively inexpensive compared to other taxable type of bond products, such that we had gotten to historic levels of cheapness compared to other taxable type of bond investments. Some of that has come back in. It's still very attractive, certainly, as John says, when you can get a taxable equivalent yield on 10 years of something over 5%. That's an attractive level of return, given what we perceive as a low inflation environment in a sluggish economy.
Yeah, something else too. I'll just throw this out for comparison, and everybody on the who's listened to us for a while knows that we don't buy the market index. We're not S&P 500 index buyers. We're much more selective than that, and look at relative value and so forth and so on. But in any case, if you look at the S&P 500 index itself and apply, for example, Professor Robert Shiller's PE10 valuation analysis, which he has run since about 1881, you can make a guess that the future return on the market index is 5 or 6%. Well, if you can buy a 10-year muni and get a taxable equivalent return of 5, you are approaching the expected annualized return from the market index, just to give you an idea of what the relative value is like. And something else, too, on a long-term basis, that people joke that Wall Street and most investors have the attention span of gnats. And we, you know, which means that you always think about what happened yesterday or last week and forget the big picture. And when you look back historically, and I'll just use the 10-year, you know, generic U.S. Treasury bond. Well, let's do it longer than that. Let's just say the long-term Treasury bond. And you know, which would include some 20- and 30-year paper, too, I guess, and go back to 1925 and come forward in 10-year increments. There has never been a 10-year span beginning in 1935 that showed a negative return on U.S. Treasuries, total return. There has never been a negative 20-year span or a 15-year span. You can't say as much for stocks. Stocks do have, on occasion, even negative 20-year returns. For example, 1929, 1949, the S&P 500 return was, I think, like a minus 1% or something like that for that particular time period. So just to kind of put things in perspective, you know, long-term bonds are good diversifiers in a portfolio to counter stock market volatility. And your risk of loss of total return in a long-term sense is much less than anybody thinks. And by the way, those comments I made about 10-year returns, that also was true, held true during the great inflation years between 1970 and 1980. So with that, I'll stop talking.
All right. Thank you, John. And we're getting a little long on time here, but we did have one question emailed in. I think it's a pretty short answer. We talked a lot about Fed tapering and reduction in bond purchases. Any new guidance on short-term rates by the Fed? That out to anybody. I know the answer.
No. I mean, well, they're going to continue short-term. Short-term rates will stay low, I guess. They have no plans at all, from what we can tell.
Still looking at 2015.
Yeah, you're still looking sometime out before changing short-term rates.
Okay, great. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you next month. Thanks.